It's time for the Edge Radio broadcast with your host, Daniel Lott. You can join Daniel and his guests as we discover the truth together. Within the continental U.S., call toll-free 1-800-996-9638 or locally here in Indiana, 359-5593. That's toll-free 1-800-996-9638 or locally at 359-5593. You can find out more about our guests and topics by logging on to The Edge's website, theedgeam.com. That's theedgeam.com. And now here's your host for The Edge Radio broadcast, is Daniel Lott.
All right, everybody, welcome back to The Edge Radio broadcast. On the line with us we have Jim Fester. Jim, are you there?
Yeah.
All right, welcome to the Edge Radio broadcast, Jim. I was just talking to the folks earlier here on the Edge and tell them that you've been on over 250 shows across the country in 5 years, and so you must evidently have a lot of information concerning the JFK assassination.
I've been keeping busy, Dan.
Yeah. How do you do it?
Real well. How do I do it?
Yeah.
I've been fortunate to work with the best qualified individuals to ever study the case. We began collaborating in 1992. In an effort to take rumor and speculation out of the case and place it on an objective and scientific foundation. These include a world authority on the human brain who's also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics who's also an MD and board certified in radiation oncology, which of course is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy, who's an expert on the interpretation of X-rays, a physician who actually not only was present attending Jack Kennedy, but 2 days later his alleged assassin Lee Oswald, a leading photo analyst in the case, a new member in collaboration, a PhD in physics with a specialty in electromagnetism, who's an expert on light and the physics of moving objects, who's made remarkable discoveries about some of the photographic evidence. I've just been lucky to work with the best qualified people to ever deal with these issues, Dan.
Wow, and I noticed you just mentioned alleged assassin. So you're saying that the one we all know and trust to be the assassin was not the assassin?
Well, let's put it this way. We have discovered that Oswald was implicated on the basis of fabricated evidence, and the question arises that if he'd been a guilty man, why would it have been necessary to frame him? He actually was on the second floor in the lunchroom at the time of the assassination. He was confronted there within 90 seconds after the shooting by a motorcycle patrolman, Marion Baker, who kept him in his sights until his supervisor, Roy Truly, came along and identified him as a person who worked in the building. He had been identified around the first or second floor by co-workers at a quarter of 12, at 12, at 12:15, as late as 12:25 by Carolyn Arnold, who was the secretary to the vice president. So he didn't have the opportunity. He didn't have the ability. He also, he was a mediocre shot. I used to supervise recruit training at San Diego and Edson Range, Camp Pendleton, where Oswald took his recruit training, marksmanship training. He was an average shot when he was in the Marine Corps as a recruit, but the following year he didn't qualify at all, which is very odd since Marine Corps policy is that everyone is to qualify. I interpret that as meaning he was probably being given language training, Russian language training, at a very highly specialized school in Monterey that the military runs. And a year later, he dropped to 190. He fired 212 in 1957, didn't qualify in 58. In 59, he fired 191, which is just barely qualifying. You have to fire at least 190 out of 250 points of five different combinations of positions and distances, Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, there's no evidence whatsoever that he maintained his marksmanship. He was qualified to use an M1, which is a semi-automatic, which of course means every time you pull the trigger, it reloads.
Uh-huh.
And not trained to use a bolt action, this mediocre bolt action weapon, Mannlicher Carcano, that had a terrible reputation. In fact, it was known in World War II as the humanitarian rifle for never harming anyone on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. Why would it be important for our listeners to know that this may have not went down the way we've been led to believe?
Well, one reason, Dan, is that a lot of the techniques that were used to fabricate evidence and to mislead the public about what happened in the case of JFK continue to this very day. They're the kinds of techniques used by experts in propaganda, especially to deceive and mislead. And I'm just sorry to say that it's the kind of thing that if you get deeply into a case, you develop a sensitivity to these matters as they go on. Even today, for example, and you'd be much less likely to be taken in or deceived by your government once you get the hang of how they do these things.
Okay, so you're saying there's a pattern of deceit that the government uses to cause certain events to transpire?
Well, it's got more to do with covering it up. I mean, the case of Jack, for example, killing him wasn't really the problem. The problem was to cover it up and to preserve the allegiance of the American people to their government. We have discovered indications that Jack was shot four different times. He was shot once in the back from behind, about 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column. A shallow shot only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger. He was shot in the throat from in front, a shot that actually passed through the windshield en route to his throat. A bullet fragment that appears to have fragmented, part going upward into the brain and part going downward into the lung. The part going upward into the brain appears to have ruptured a tough membrane that covers a compact part of the brain called the cerebellum, the tentorium. And then he was shot twice in the head after the driver brought the limousine to a halt in Dealey Plaza. Once in the back of the head by a shot that may have been with a Mannlicher Carcano. Most of the shooters were using different caliber weapons, you know, their preferred weapon. And therefore, it would become extremely important subsequently to get a hold of the body and remove the bullet fragments so they couldn't be compared for caliber. And then he was shot finally in the right temple by a frangible exploding bullet fired from the right front that the shock waves set up, blew his brains out the back of his head with such force that motorcycle patrolman the left rear, who was impacted by the skull and brains, thought he himself had been shot. A triangular chunk of Jack's skull would be found on Saturday afternoon by a medical student named William Harper, who took it to Methodist Hospital, where he had relatives on the staff who photographed it, fortunately, because, like much of the other evidence in this case, after it was turned over to the FBI, it simply disappeared.
Well, let me ask you this, then. You're saying, then, that that the actual assassination itself was based on the fact that the allegiance of the government was slipping and he had to be shot?
No. What I'm saying is that killing a president isn't necessarily a hard part. Covering it up and preserving the allegiance of the people to the new government. I mean, essentially, all of our evidence suggests that this was a covert coup d'etat. A public or open coup d'etat, Dan, would be one where everyone knows what's going on. But the American people had such devotion to Jack Kennedy, such enthusiasm for him as a person. You know, he was admired, even adored around the world, that the public would never have stood for it. So the motives for taking Jack out are multitudinous, but some especially important ones include that the Joint Chiefs had lost faith in Jack Kennedy. They'd reached a point in American history where they were actually rather paranoid about the international communist conspiracy. Jack had refused to invade Cuba against their unanimous recommendation. He'd gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union against their unanimous opposition, and now he was pulling American forces out of Vietnam, where they believed that a stand had to be taken against the menace of international communism. A book by James Bamford entitled Body of Secrets is particularly good in discussing schemes the Joint Chiefs were bringing to JFK for phony events that were supposed to indicate that Castro was taking action against the United States in order to precipitate or provide a rationale for attacking Cuba. But Jack was having these all vetted by Maxwell Taylor and was rejecting them one after another after another. They included schemes like suggesting that if the Atlas rocket that would carry astronaut John Glenn into space were to blow up, they'd have irrefutable evidence that the Cubans had done it. My interpretation is the only way they could have irrefutable evidence would be by planning it themselves and perhaps, you know, carrying out the entire scheme, causing the rocket to blow up. Another was to load a commercial airliner full of college students on a holiday, fly it over Cuba, and shoot it down, where the list of names in the paper would be incendiary, and the American people would rise up and insist that we had to invade Cuba, there was a secret aspect of this was supposed to be landing the plane, offloading the college students, and then filling it with dummies. But, I mean, if any of these dummies had been recovered, or if these students, you know, were found wandering around the United States, I mean, it would have disclosed the whole charade. So I think, in fact, they really did intend that they would shoot down this plane and all these college students would die for the sake of a greater cause, the noble cause of precipitating a war with Cuba. Actually, when Lee Oswald was in New Orleans, he was being given a phony persona as a pro-Castro communist sympathizer and handing out leaflets for this Fair Play for Cuba committee, where, oddly enough, he was the only member of the committee in New Orleans at the time, and actually he was working with former FBI agent Guy Bannister and others there who were gun-running to Cuba for anti-Castro Cubans. So Oswald, it's pretty clear, and his entire history, I think, would, you know, suggest that he was involved, recruited early on in the Marine Corps, probably by the Office of Naval Intelligence. He was then stationed at Atsugi, which is the most secure base in the American military arsenal at the time. It was the source of these U-2 overflights. His defection to the Soviet Union appears to have been a stunt. He renounced his citizenship on a Sunday when the embassy was closed. It had no legal significance. In all probability, he was bringing the Soviets information about the altitude at which these U-2 flights were taking place. The Soviets knew, of course, they were happening, but were unable to do anything about it because they didn't have enough information. And, of course, lo and behold, when we have a summit about to take place between Eisenhower and Khrushchev, a summit that's going to reduce Cold War tensions, what happens? But Gary Francis Powers is shot down out of the sky. He doesn't blow up his plane. He doesn't take a cyanide tablet, and Khrushchev is able to parade him around, embarrassing Eisenhower, aborting the summit, and actually increasing rather than decreasing Cold War tensions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, as we go through the interview tonight, I'll ask you some questions. And one of the questions I have for you, of course, now, you know, when you just mention JFK as maybe not being the way that it happened, that you could instantly face ridicule for that. Evidently, you must know something so significant, or that you found out things that you risk your reputation, you put your investment of money and time in writing books. You must believe that there's something more to meets the eye than and even risk that ridicule. I'm sure. Are you ridiculed at any point for having other points of view?
Oh, no. Over 80% of the American people don't believe what the Warren Commission has told them, Dan, and believe that, you know, it was a conspiracy. And what we have done is to shatter all the illusions. We have proven on the basis of objective and scientific evidence that the whole Warren Commission investigation was a charade. It was based upon phony medical evidence. The medical evidence in this case had been extensively altered, including what's usually taken to be the most basic evidence, namely the autopsy x-rays. They had been changed to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head, but by using a patch that was much too dense to be human bone, so that David W. Mantic, MD, PhD, he's got a PhD in physics, he's also board certified in radiation oncology, was able to go into the National Archives and study the original, what purport to be the original x-rays, and perform a simple test from physics.
Right,
called optical densitometry, that enables you to measure the amount of light that passes through an x-ray and calculate on that basis the relative density of the objects whose exposure to radiation created the image. And what he did was discover that there's an area at the back of the right lateral cranial x-ray, this is the x-ray of Jack Kennedy's skull taken from the right side, where much too much light passes through. In other words, the material that was used to create a patch to a massive blowout to the back of his head was done using material much too dense to be human bone, so that unless the back of Jack Kennedy's skull was nothing but solid bone, unless Jack Kennedy was a bonehead, in other words, this is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. And when you outline or delineate the dimensions of this area that has been subjected to this extreme kind of patch, it corresponds very closely with the eyewitnesses, of whom there were more than 40 who had observed this blowout to the back of the head, including diagrams that were made by physicians of the appearance of the back of the head. And it's very evident that that was the way in which the government deflected all of the eyewitness testimony to the blowout to the back of the head, which, of course, had been caused by a shot from the right front, namely by changing the X-ray. David also discovered that the anterior posterior or front to rear X-ray of Jack Kennedy's skull has been altered by adding a almost round metallic slice of a 6.5 millimeter what would appear to be purporting to be a bullet, of course, fired from an obscure World War II 6.5 millimeter weapon. In fact, I'm convinced, Dan, that a reason for picking this weapon, which incidentally was not even a high velocity weapon, it only has a muzzle velocity of 2,000 feet per second, which means if, as the Warren Commission reported, the death certificates claimed, even articles that would subsequently appear in the Journal of the American Medical Association would insist Jack Kennedy was killed by the impact of high-velocity bullets, then he cannot have been killed by Lee Oswald because the Mannlicher Carcano doesn't fire them. So that when they framed Oswald, they made a number of mistakes. But I believe, in part, the reason for using this obscure weapon was because it had an odd caliber. If you'd killed Jack using a 30 caliber or a 30-06 or something like that, my God, there would be, you know, hundreds and thousands of these weapons in Dallas, and it would have been very difficult to identify the weapon. But if you take a very odd caliber weapon and, of course, conveniently plant it in the book depository building.
Conveniently.
Yeah. Then you have a way of, and then create a paper trail. I mean, this is another peculiar thing, you know, why Oswald ought to have ordered a mediocre weapon that had been mass-produced by the Italians in World War II from a sporting goods store in Chicago, when on any street corner in Dallas, virtually, he could have purchased a superior weapon with less identification, is, you know, completely bizarre unless you begin to speculate that he was being set up, which is very obviously the case. So what they did was they added this 6.5 millimeter metallic slice to the autopsy X-ray to link it with this obscure World War II weapon as another way of implicating Oswald. Now what's crucial to understand here, Dan, among other things, is that these X-rays were under control of officers of the United States Navy, members of the Secret Service and the President's personal physician. In other words, the Mafia, for example, which I'm confident put up some of the shooters, could not have extended its reach into Bethesda Naval Hospital to alter these X-rays that were under control of the government.
Mm-hmm. Had to be somebody on the inside.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In fact, the beat goes on. Not only did they patch the X-ray to conceal this massive blowout to the back of the head, but they reconstituted Jack's brain. They did that by having two brain examinations, one held on the 25th. That was Monday, the day of the formal state funeral. We've just gone through an analogous formal state funeral here, of course, where they had the supplemental autopsy exam on the brain, which must have been a kind of a, you know, miserable, awful-looking chunk of neurons because over half of it had been blown out. But then a week later, they had a second brain examination, and the two naval pathologists who were involved, who'd never conducted an autopsy on a gunshot victim before, were joined for this second examination by an Army lieutenant colonel, oddly enough, by the name of Pierre Fink. And they reported the second brain they examined was a virtually completely intact brain, weighed in at 1,500 grams. Now, I mentioned the World Authority on the Human Brain. Robert B. Livingston, M.D., who also was an expert on wound ballistics, having supervised an emergency medical hospital for injured Okinawans and Japanese prisoners of war during the Battle of Okinawa. This guy, Dan, was the scientific director of the National Institute for Mental Health and the National Institute for Neurological Diseases and Blindness in both the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. His qualifications were so great that when he came into government, they had to create a new higher civil service rank for somebody who was, you know, so exceptional. In fact, of all the scholars and academicians I met in my entire life, I've never known one of greater distinction than Bob Livingston. Mm-hmm. Well, he reviewed the autopsy data, the reports from the physicians about the damage to the brain and the fact that two kinds of brain tissue were seen extruding from this huge wound at Bethesda, namely both cerebral and cerebellar tissue, and noticed that in the diagrams and photographs in the National Archives that purport to be of the brain of JFK, the cerebellum is completely intact and the cerebrum is barely damaged. In mm-hmm. fact, this brain was weighed in at 1,500 grams, and Bob explained to me that a normal adult human brain only runs between 1,350 and 1,400 grams, so this would have been an abnormally large brain by any standard. But what's crucial is it can't possibly be the brain of JFK.
Yeah, have you ever heard of brain heal thyself? Hey, Jim, we got to go to break here. We'll come right back. We'll talk a little bit more about those x-rays.
You got it.
Right after this. And welcome back to the Edge Radio Broadcast. I'm your host, Daniel Lott. On the line with us, we have Jim Fesner, PhD. Jim, we were talking about the strange appearing and disappearing brain matter. Who's changing the brains?
Well, that's a great question. It had to have been done by these medical officers, and it had to be something of which the Secret Service were aware. In fact, Dan, we have more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting up Jack for the hit, including that Secret Service agents were discouraged from riding alongside of the limousine already at Love Field, that there was no surveillance of the buildings along the motorcade route. The windows were left open when they should have been secured.
Are we talking about John Kennedy or Jack Kennedy?
John Fitzgerald Kennedy was, you know, commonly known as Jack.
Oh, I didn't know that. Hopefully, listeners, I guess I may be the only one, but okay.
All right, I see. Yeah, sure. No, when I'm talking about Jack, I'm talking about JFK.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I've spent so many years on this. I'll just talk about JFK.
There
they didn't
you
weld
go.
The manhole cover shut.
There
the
you
112th
go.
Military Intelligence Unit, which normally would have been distributed throughout the city for crowd control, was ordered to stand down. The crowd was allowed to spill out into the streets. In some places, it was 8 to 12 persons deep. They took an improper route that involved a turn of more than 90 degrees in violation of Secret Service protocol.
Mm-hmm.
They chose a motorcade route that they did not need to choose that required the limousine to slow down dramatically, I believe, to achieve precisely that effect without alarming the occupants. After the bullets began to be fired, the driver, William Greer, actually pulled the limousine to the left and brought it to a halt for several seconds, during which JFK was hit twice in the head, once in the back of the head from a location that appears to have been on the second floor of the Daltex building, where there was a closet for a uranium mining operation that was a CIA front, and then hit from the right front, apparently from a location at the intersection of the Triple Underpass and the grassy knoll, the picket fence on the grassy knoll, where there was an above-ground sewer where a man could have pretty good concealment and ideal shooting location if he had a little camouflage above him. Mm-hmm. Just as a shot to the throat that passed through the windshield appears to have been fired from the same above-ground sewer opening on the opposite side. And then after taking getting the limousine to Parkland Hospital, Secret Service agents took a bucket of water and a sponge and started to wash the blood and brains out of the limousine. The vehicle was taken Monday back to the Ford Motor Company where it was completely rebuilt. Now you gotta understand, Dan, this was a crime scene on wheels. And here it was taken to Ford Motor Company and completely rebuilt, stripped down to bare metal and rebuilt. The seats were pulled out. All the blood, any indications of, you know, brain and blood spray were demolished. Any bullet holes or any damage, you know, to the limousine. And there was, for example, an indentation in a chrome strip above the front windshield by a shot fired from behind that missed. There was a through and through hole in the windshield. We actually tracked down the fellow at Ford Motor Company who was responsible for replacing it, who assured us that indeed that there had been such a hole in the windshield. They replaced it with a brand new windshield, and yet subsequently the Secret Service would produce yet a third windshield that showed some cracks, which they claimed had been caused by fragments from a bullet fired from behind. Subsequently, of course, the autopsy x-rays exposed and developed would be taken by the same Secret Service agent who was in charge of the vehicle during the assassination, Roy Kellerman, just as the autopsy photographs would be taken, exposed but not yet developed. And the next time that we have access to these x-rays and photographs, they have undergone transformation. The kinds of changes have been made to the x-rays I've already described, and the autopsy photograph sequence has undergone remarkable changes, such that John Stringer, for example, who was responsible for taking the photographs, denied that the photographs in the set that now is available and exists are the photographs that he took. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it appears that they were reshot over the weekend, that the autopsy sequence was reshot in order to alter the appearance of the wounds and especially conceal the massive blow-up to the back of the head.
Now, it seems that the government has a way with changing photographs and x-rays sometime. Now, have you done any research at all on the Ron Brown murder?
I haven't myself, but I know I have heard the reports that he had a bullet hole in the back of his skull.
Right. He also had the strange mystery of the disappearing x-rays. They evidently had some, and then they disappeared. Government seems to not know where they went. I would think that would be a good assassination science project for you, because not only that, but it turns out that somebody did take one x-ray of his head, and it showed snow. That what you would get from an imploding bullet through the head. But again, those things just kind of disappeared. In fact, that was one of the only cases in American history where there was an airplane crash and no autopsy was performed. They wanted to get the bodies quickly into the ground.
Well, that's very good, Dan, because that is, you know, this is there's a pattern here. And not only the FBI, but even the National Transportation Safety Board seems to be playing a role in covering these things up. So I find it profoundly disturbing. See, of course, if Jack's brain were still around, it could be examined. It could be dissected very minutely, and you could determine with great precision how many times he'd been shot in the head and from what directions. But the brain itself, of course, is mysteriously disappearing, which is why... Why we have to, you know, look at diagrams and photographs that have been offered in its place.
Well, something of that importance, you wouldn't think that somebody just lost it.
No, I agree. Now, there may be an innocuous explanation. When Jack was buried at Arlington, they had to construct this elaborate funeral site, and they had to reinter the body, and it's possible that in, I think it was 1964, Bobby might have had the brain placed in the casket to put the body together. In which case could account for that. But the fact is the diagrams and the photographs that are supposed to be those of Jack Kennedy can't possibly be those of Jack Kennedy. And when you talk about, you know, altering photographs, this also took place in the case of Lee Oswald. There's this very famous photograph of him allegedly taken in the backyard by his wife, where he's holding his Mannlicher Gargano, he's wearing a pistol belt with a revolver with which he's alleged to have shot a policeman by the name of J.D. Tippett, and he's holding two newspapers, which are communist newspapers. One's the Militant, one's the Worker. And that's interesting all by itself, Dan, because the Militant and the Worker had such different ideologies that members of the, you know, those who would follow the philosophy of one would, if they encountered members of the other, they'd get in fights and even try to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
I have a colleague, a former colleague, who's an expert on the history of communism, who explained to me how odd it would be for somebody to, you know, be subscribing to both papers. So here he's holding them both. Now, there have been a lot of questions about this photograph, which turns out to be one of a series of three or four, all of which have what appears to be the very same face with the very same expression, even though he's holding these weapons in different ways and so forth. And not only did it appear to be the same face with the same expression, but the shadow beneath the nose and so forth seems inconsistent with the rest of the shadows. There appears to be an insert line at the chin. It's not Oswald's chin. Oswald had a rather pointed chin with a cleft, and the chin here is kind of a block chin with no cleft. Mm-hmm. So there have been reasons to suspect that this was an altered photograph. And when Lee Oswald himself was shown this photograph, he said it was his face placed on somebody else's body, and that he knew a lot about photography, and he was sure that that was something that could be proven. Well, there are a lot of places where you can find discussion of this. An excellent one is a book by Robert Groden entitled The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, where he has a very good discussion of this, and also of the Tippett shooting, a matter to which we can return. But Jack White, who's perhaps the leading student of the photographic record in the assassination of Jack Kennedy, has offered a proof of its alteration using those newspapers whose dimensions are known as an internal ruler. When you use the newspapers as an internal ruler, you can lay it off and measure from the sole of the foot to the top of the head and determine the height of the individual in the photograph. And he turns out to be about 5'6" tall. But Lee Oswald was about 5'10". So the person in the photograph is too small to be Lee Oswald. Or alternatively, when they created the photograph, they put the newspapers in too large, so that it created an imperfect scale, and even if the person was about the same height as Lee Oswald, then you get a false reading because the papers were too large. Either way, of course, it's additional evidence that the photographs have been faked. And indeed, mm-hmm. later years, when the Dallas police files were opened, an insert mat was discovered that gives an outline of the silhouette of the figure that's going to be altered by adding features to it, or by inserting a photograph of a face on a pre-existing photograph. It was tracked back to a detective who said he had only created the mat to see if it could be done. Mm-hmm. Now, that's, of course, a ludicrous explanation. You know, you'd have to go to great pains to create one of these mats. The only reason for doing it would be if you were actually going to be faking mm-hmm. photographs. So they actually traced back. You know, this was a completely unintended consequence of opening the Dallas files. Well, they actually tracked it back to the detective who apparently had actually performed the fakery.
What you're talking about is just, I remember just seeing a report the other day talking about celebrities these days. You may get the head of your favorite celebrity, but a lot of times you'll get three or four different people's body parts. And so that pasting together of that is kind of rampant. That's just part of the course.
Dan, what you're saying is so true today. You see, with digital technology, you can put together, you know, you can create any image you want. I mean, go and see some of the, you know, currently popular films, for example, and how realistic they are. Van Helsing is a particularly good example. Wonderful effects, absolutely convincing, but they're, you know, the overwhelming majority of them are all done with digital technology. Now, in those days, that sophisticated ability wasn't available. So that when, in fact, it came to the photographic record, what happened was the government vacuumed up as many of the photographs and films as it possibly could in Dealey Plaza. There were FBI agents stationed at the photo processing labs in Dallas for 2 weeks after the assassination. They actually approached individuals. Government agents were approaching individuals in the Dealey Plaza where the assassination took place immediately after the event, which is all too telling all by itself. For example, a woman by the name of Jean Hill, who had been standing opposite the grassy knoll with her girlfriend, Mary Mormon, who had a Polaroid camera because they had boyfriends who were among the motorcycle police escorts, mm-hmm. and who took one of the most famous photographs toward the grassy knoll just instantly after Jack had been hit. In fact, if you look on the right shoulder, you can see what appears to be a chunk of his scalp is there on the right shoulder. Very famous photograph. So she was there helping her friend, because in those days when you took a Polaroid, it had to be coated. You had to take it off and you had to give it this, peel it off and give it this coating so it would develop properly. Mm-hmm. And Jean Hill, was apprehended by federal agents immediately after the assassination, taken to a building in the Dealey Plaza vicinity and grilled for about an hour and a half. And when she explained that at least one of the shots had come from the grassy knoll, they told her, no, that wasn't possible because there'd only been three shots and they'd all been from above and behind. Which, of course, since there'd been no investigation of the crime yet, since Dealey Plaza, the acoustics are such that depending where you're standing, no matter how many shots had been fired, there would be conflicting reports about how many had been heard. And in this case, most of the shots appear to have been fired with silenced weapons anyway. There's no way that, anyone could know that there only been three shots fired from above and behind unless that had been a planted story, a cover story that was going to be used. And in fact was inserted it was being promulgated around the world very fast, the idea that there was this lone, demented shooter who'd fired three shots. Mm-hmm. The initial reports, by the way, Dan, from the Secret Service and the FBI, the initial scenario had all three shots hitting. The first shot hitting Jack about 5.5 inches below the collar, the second hitting John Connolly, and then the third hitting Jack in the back of the head and killing him. Now, the shot to Connolly is very significant because he was shot just to the below his right shoulder, near his right armpit, shattered a rib, exited below his right nipple, went in, impacted the right he had a wound in his right wrist, and he had another a bullet that went in his a bullet was lodged in his left thigh, and the problem became how to accommodate all these wounds in Connolly, using only one bullet. But it became much, much worse when it turned out that a distant bystander by the name of James Tague had actually been injured by a fragment of a shot that had hit the curb and actually caused him to have blood on his cheek. And since you had this record of him having hit by a bullet that missed altogether, now the official story had to be contracted from three shots and three hits to three shots with one miss.
Amazing how the story changes there. Hey, before you came on the air, I was anytime you allude to the JFK assassination, people instantly think, oh, you know, I don't know. But I was pointing out that when they were trying the Ruby Ridge case with Randy Weaver up there, when the FBI agents and whatnot, the ATF came up there and assassinated his son and killed his dog, the judge in that case said she's never seen a more blatant worse case of the government manufacturing evidence in any case. I tried to tell them that, people, yes, the government does manufacture evidence.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. And, you know, you get lies from the highest echelon. I mean, I was just reflecting on the, you know, what's going on here as the government's trying to cover up the involvement of the, it appears to me, not just the Secretary of Defense, but the Attorney General and the President of the United States and all these, this use of torture in Abu Ghraib prison. Because it's very clear now from the memoranda that are leaking out that Department of Justice and Department of Defense attorneys had been working on the rationale that was supposed to allow these enemy combatants to be subjected to torture, claiming that it was consistent with the Geneva Conventions or that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply. And it's pretty obvious that Bush was involved in giving approval for this. So that just yesterday he was saying to the press that he instructed everyone that they should follow the law.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, Dan. Follow the law. The question is, well, what does the law say? And they had all these attorneys, you see, who were saying that it was consistent with the law that they should torture these people. So what Bush is doing is equivocating by saying, you know, he told them to follow the law, but the law he was telling them to follow was the law as interpreted by these legal beagles for the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense who were saying you didn't need to follow Geneva Convention. So,
Well, also they're kind of holding back information regarding the Saudis and 9/11. They're a favored group, and so the Bush administration does not want them to be implicated. But I thought, wasn't 18 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi? They're just hiding that information.
Yeah, 15 or 16 of the 19 were Saudis, and none of them were Iraqis. And, of course, the CIA had assured the American government that for at least 10 years, Iraq had not been engaged in acts of terrorism. So Bush still continues to give these phony arguments trying to associate Iraq with terrorism, which is true today in the sense that, you know, since the United States invaded Iraq, now it's become a veritable mecca for terrorists from around the country because it's a shooting gallery. I mean, we are so distributed with too small a force against too large a population because the Secretary of Defense doesn't want to admit that he made gross miscalculations as to the size of force that would be required. You find all this kind of double talk taking place. You find now a cannibalization of the National Guard and the Reserve. It's terrible, Dan. I mean, they are dramatically weakening the United States in terms of its military power. They're pulling troops from Germany and from South Korea. My God, if there's any place in the world where we should not be pulling troops out, it's South Korea, because the North Koreans have a really legitimate nuclear military capacity, and to suggest that we are in any way wavering in our military commitment to South Korea is just too much of an invitation to, you know, allow the North to dominate the South. It's a terrible, terrible thing that's going on, all because Donald Rumsfeld doesn't want to admit that he made a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I'm particularly upset with the fact that they're asking a lot of soldiers to extend their tour after their tour was over.
These stop-loss orders appear to me to be unconstitutional. You know, we have prohibitions against involuntary servitude, Dan, and you're absolutely correct. This is turning soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen into slaves. Mm-hmm. It's I'm convinced it's unconstitutional.
Well, this type of thing is important to know, these other asides, because, again, that goes with the trend that's been going on in this country for a long time. We do not get the facts as the masses. And if we want the real truth, we have to go to alternative sources and use science or whatever other means we have to validate those facts.
That's absolutely right, Dan. That's absolutely right. Now, you may or may not have mentioned to your audience, but I have a website that might interest some of your listeners. It's www.assassinationscience.com. And on that website, I have many studies about 911. Now, if you scan down the menu bar on the left and come down to 911 websites, there's a link called 15 Studies Plus. And if you go to 15 Studies Plus, you're going to be taken to a page that shows photographs of the Pentagon taken immediately after the hit. And you'll discover that the point at where the Pentagon was hit was very, very small. It wasn't much bigger than the double doors on a decent-sized mansion. You'll find that the facade of the building was otherwise largely undamaged, that you even have some windows where you have glass windows still in place in the immediate vicinity of the hit point.
Jim, we've got to go to break. We'll pick you right up after the break. And when we do, we want to talk about whether the Zapruder film was a hoax or not. You're listening to the Edge Radio Broadcast with Daniel Ott. Special free Jim, and thanks for being on the Edge Radio Broadcast. On the line with us, we have Jim Fetzner, PhD. Jim, was the Zapruder film a hoax?
Well, Dan, I'm sorry to say that it does appear to have been a hoax. Just to continue that thought about the Pentagon one step further, however, not only does it turn out that the hit point is much too small to have accommodated a Boeing 757, but you see none of the kinds of damage to the building that would have been caused by the wingspan, the size of the plane. You don't see any remnants of the fuselage. You don't see any seats. You don't see any wings. You don't even see the engines, which are practically indestructible. You don't see the tail. The tail is one of the structurally strongest parts of an aircraft. Most certainly that tail would be obvious and conspicuous if a Boeing 757 had hit the Pentagon. It's very evident when you stop and consider the evidence from the photographic evidence from taken immediately after. Before the ceiling, the top floors collapsed, and it's very odd to ask why those floors even collapsed if that wasn't done based upon some sort of prearrangement of demolitions to try to create the image that a large aircraft had hit the building, because no Boeing 757 hit the Pentagon. And therefore the government and the Secretary of Defense have been lying to the American people, Dan, about a very obvious aspect of what's supposed to have taken place on 9/11. This, of course, has been compounded by remarks by Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, to the effect that no one could ever have imagined planes being used as weapons against buildings, which is complete and utter nonsense. I mean, just to offer one illustration, there was actually a simulated attack on the Pentagon that was conducted a year before to see what kind of damage would be done if a plane were used to hit the Pentagon itself, which shows that we're getting lies, you know, at all levels of the, all of the highest levels of the American government about one issue or another. So when we go back to the Zapruder film about which you asked, Dan, this was a very clever thing to do, namely to, you know, people might ask, well, why was a president, you know, assassinated in public in daylight? I mean, you could have killed him many different ways. And I repeat the point I made earlier. Yes, you could have killed him, but covering it up, you know, would if he died in the middle of the night in the White House, no one would have believed it wasn't a conspiracy. No one would have believed that there wasn't plotting afoot. No one would have believed that, for example, Lyndon Johnson or J. Edgar Hoover had been involved. And, in fact, we have a lot of evidence that J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon Johnson were involved. But by assassinating the man in public in a major American city, and by creating a film that presents a fake depiction by removing, for example, the driver pulling the limousine to a halt and stopping for about 2 seconds, during which he's hit twice in the head, by taking all of that out and by reducing the amount of time available, you completely distort the chronological record. So if anyone actually is being diligent in trying to piece together what actually happened to JFK based upon the assumption that the film is authentic, it'll be impossible for them to do it. for the simple reason that the film itself is not authentic and gives a false depiction of what took place.
Now, when I looked at the film, of the Pentagon, I do agree I did not see any plane parts whatsoever. What do you say to our listeners? We have one just called in just while you were there a little bit ago, and it said, what evidence do you have the plane never hit?
Something hit the Pentagon. I'm just saying it's not a boat. It wasn't any Boeing 757. Here's one reason. Whatever hit the Pentagon penetrated all the way through the third circle of the Pentagon. Now, that had to be something with a very hard nose. The nose of a Boeing 757 is filled with electronics. That's very sensitive. No Boeing 757 could have made it through the third ring of the Pentagon, but some of the witnesses said that what hit the Pentagon looked just like a cruise missile with wings. Well, I'll tell you, Dan, nothing looks more like a cruise missile with wings than a cruise missile with wings. And the Tomahawk, for example, has a depleted uranium nose cone, which could have penetrated through the third ring of the Pentagon. So my suspicion is that what hit the Pentagon was actually probably a cruise missile. And It appears to have been a clever deception where some sort of commercial airliner flew over the building at approximately the same time it was hit, or very near to that, probably heading into a Washington airport, and, where it would be lost amidst all the other flights that were going in and out, but that this thing was rather cleverly done. You know, air traffic controllers who were following this, whatever hit the Pentagon, said they were convinced it had to be a fighter aircraft because it was so maneuverable. I mean, they were paying a lot of attention to this.
Mm-hmm.
And in their opinion, the flight characteristics, the maneuverability of what hit the Pentagon was inconsistent with a commercial airliner.
Well, for those doubters out there, I'm also aware, of course, there were, I thought I read 244 eyewitnesses saying a missile struck Flight 800 off the coast.
Well, you know, the more you get into that, the more plausible that appears. That is, in fact, the way I am inclined to look at what happened to TWA-802. It appears to have been a missile fired from a United States submarine on a training mission. Now, whether it was an accident or on purpose is another matter. It may have been an accidental launching of a missile, but I think that evidence is serious and needs to be taken responsibly. You see, it's like the eyewitnesses to the JFK, this big blowout to the back of the head, but they got an x-rays that doesn't show it, so they discount the eyewitnesses. So what's the Navy saying? You know, on what basis are they discounting all the eyewitnesses who say that a missile hit TWA-800? See, I mean, similar kinds of techniques are being used over and over and over to manipulate and mislead the American people.
What would be the gain for the government? You said for the public to maintain their allegiance to the government. Is there another ulterior motive that the government would have to mislead us on these types of things?
Well, if you want to talk about JFK, a number of groups were very upset with JFK. Of course, Southerners were upset because he was integrating Southern schools. They didn't like that. And, of course, most Southerners weren't very sympathetic to Jack being a Roman Catholic. We tend to forget about that, but it was controversial in his day.
Mm-hmm.
Texas oilmen were upset with Jack because he was planning to cut the oil depletion allowance, which is this huge tax write-off they get on the basis of the claim that they're putting themselves out of business by pumping oil out of the ground since it's a finite resource. He was going to reform the Federal Reserve System. I recall as a Marine Corps officer having in my hand a dollar bill that had a red imprint that said United States note instead of Federal Reserve note with a green imprint. What Jack was doing was having the Treasury Department print United States currency instead of the Federal Reserve. And, of course, we pay the Federal Reserve interest, you know, money for printing our money, and Jack thought that was unnecessary and was avoiding it. He was threatening to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. The CIA had misled him about the prospects for success of this ragtag band invading Cuba, mm-hmm. what's come to be known as the Bay of Pigs. Turns out, Dan, this will shock your listeners, turns out that the CIA had learned that the Soviets knew the date of the invasion and had passed that information on to Castro, but they never advised the commander-in-chief that that was the case. I believe if JFK had known that Castro knew we were coming, he would have called off the invasion, but in fact the CIA didn't even tell him. Mm-hmm. And of course later would blame the disaster on Jack Kennedy, when in fact it was really a deliberate effort to draw the young, inexperienced president into a situation where either he'd have a catastrophic failure, which is of course what happened when Castro handily rounded up all these people, or he'd send in the Marines to make it a success. They were hoping, planning, assuming he would send in the Marines and turn this into a full-scale American invasion, but he had no such interest in doing that and, of course, refused to do it and uncovered that the CIA was really pulling a bait and switch on him. The mob wanted to regain their control of the resorts and casinos in Havana where they were running the biggest money laundering operation in the Western Hemisphere. They also wanted to get Bobby off their backs. There's some speculation that Joe Kennedy may have entered into agreement with Sam Giancana, the mob boss of Chicago, that if the election were close, Sam would make sure Chicago went for JFK in a big way, and with it, Illinois. And, of course, it was close, and Chicago did go for Jack in a big way, and with it, Illinois. But I do not believe that Bobby or Jack would ever themselves have been a party to any such agreement. So if there was such an understanding, it would have been between Joe Kennedy and Sam Giancana, and not have involved Bobby and Jack. So when Jack made Bobby the Attorney General, of course, he began cracking down on organized crime, the very existence of which J. Edgar Hoover had denied for decades. Apparently, on the basis of the mob having the goods on Hoover, just as Hoover had the goods on most of the politicians in Washington, Hoover kept these very detailed, very explicit sex dossiers on members of Congress that he used to control them. Apparently, the mob had a similar dossier on Hoover that showed him in a compromising situation with his close personal friend Clyde Tolson, and that they were able to, keep him from paying any attention at all to the mob on the basis of threatening to expose him.
When the files on the Republicans, about 1,000 Republicans, were found on Hillary Clinton's desk in the White House, were they sending a message out, "Don't mess with us, we have your files"?
I don't believe that, Dan. I don't know about those. I am unaware of any effort by the, Hillary or Bill to blackmail or extort. I just don't know that of them. All right. Now, there are people out there who may make those claims, and I can't claim to be sufficiently expert on it that I could give you chapter and verse on everything, that Bill and Hillary have or haven't done. I'll just say I haven't been led to discover, anything that suggests to me that they were involved in that sort of activity.
Yeah. No,
I grant you there's something funny going on with Ron Brown's death and why that would be taking place. He was a close political ally of Bill Clinton. I don't know any reason why Bill Clinton would have an interest in Ron Brown being dead.
Well, you need to go ahead and research that, because the fact was he had 75 pending indictments against him, and he was quoted as saying, "If I go down at my age, I'm bringing Bill Clinton down too." And then a week later, his plane was found wrecked in Bosnia.
Well, I'll just tell you that you're right. I'm completely unaware of that, Dan. So.
Yeah.
If we get back to the JFK case, however, where I can claim to possess some expertise, we have a huge amount of evidence that the film was essentially recreated, and the recreation involves using techniques of optical printing and special effects, and it was a very sophisticated operation. Using optical printers, Dan, you can combine any foreground with any background, so you can actually put films together. Hollywood does this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that they had footage. There was some genuine footage taken in Dealey Plaza that was used from probably two or three closely related perspectives. In other words, there was more than one cameraman taking film in Dealey Plaza that was used to concoct this film. For your listeners, they might want to know, hearing me sketch out some of the conclusions, where they can find the evidence. And I might just mention, Dan, that if they're interested in the evidence about the alteration of the X-rays and the substitution of the brain, the first book I published on this subject, Assassination Science, brought together 11 different experts on aspects of the case, but including Bob Livingston, World Authority on the Human Brain, David W. Mantic, MD, PhD on the autopsy X-rays. You'll find the original studies there in Assassination Science. And also Charles Crenshaw, MD, who was there, observing, present when Jack died, and also attended Lee Oswald 2 days later. He actually got a phone call, by the way. An operator at the hospital said there was a call for whoever was responsible, looking after Lee Oswald. And when he got on the phone, he heard this booming, very familiar voice saying, "This is Lyndon Johnson," and telling him, Crenshaw, that he wanted to have a deathbed confession from Lee Oswald. And Crenshaw told him told LBJ that he thought he was going to get better and that there wasn't going to be a deathbed confession, but Johnson told him there's going to be a guy there in the operating room who was going to take it. He came back and he said there was a very sinister looking guy in a trench coat there, but that Oswald took a turn for the worse and died, and there was no occasion for any conversation with him.
I wonder if he had any help dying.
Well, it's a great question, Dan. It's very peculiar, the huge amount of damage that was done by this shot to Oswald. Plus, the first thing they did, he appears to have been set up. He was changed into all dark clothing before they made the transfer, which is, I think, for the purpose that you couldn't see where the blood pattern was because the clothing was all dark. After he was shot, and of course it was an internal wound with a lot of internal injury, he was subjected to CPR, which is the last thing you should do because it promotes internal bleeding. You can't know exactly what was going on in the ambulance on the way to the Parkland Hospital. And while, you know, Crenshaw thought that he was getting better, I mean, I don't know what was going on. You know, Crenshaw couldn't even say what was going on when he was out of the trauma room. But he was destined not to live a long, happy life. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they had to silence him. He just knew too much.
What was Jackie Kennedy reaching for on the back of that Lincoln?
She was going after a chunk of Jack's skull and brains had been blown out and was on the back of the trunk. In fact, there was a lot of, brain matter that was blown across the trunk. Several Secret Service agents were nauseated when they saw it. And that's another way in which they had to clean up the film. They had to get all that debris off of the trunk. Mm-hmm. We found somebody who was working at the National Photographic Interpretation Center, a fellow named Homer McMahon, who has brought a copy of a film of the assassination Friday night of the assassination, who studied it. He was asked to prepare a briefing board for an unspecified government official who I suspect was either J. Edgar Hoover or Lyndon Johnson himself, and he was supposed to identify the impacts of bullets on the body. He said there were 6 to 8 impacts. He actually said 6 to 8 impacts on Jack, but I think he's talking about 6 to 8 total on, you know, occupants of the limo, which was really his task. So if you have, the 4 in Jack and as many as 3 in John Connolly, to accommodate, then you get the number 7, which is between 6 and 8. Now that's very striking because if you look at the, you know, what we have today, the existing film, you can't see anything like 6 to 8 impacts on occupants of the limousine. I mean, it's just clear that the whole thing has been completely reworked in such a way that it no longer satisfies the description where Homer McMahon, who watched the thing at least 10 times, I mean, this guy is a real expert on the assassination in terms of the visual record, having seen what appears to have been an authentic mm-hmm. motion picture right off the bat.
Now, did I see in the Zapruder film or somewhere else, did I see that as that limo headed to an overpass or something, was there a car in a underpass?
Yeah, there was a pilot car that had been going ahead of the presidential limousine that actually hesitated, and that's very peculiar. You know, why were they hesitating there? Why were they just driving forward? And that's, of course, a very suspicious element. By the way, there's a whole book, as you are aware, but maybe some of your listeners are not. My most recent book on the assassination is devoted to the way in which the photographic record has been altered, and it's entitled The Great Zapruder Film Hoax. And in between those two books, Dan, I published a second entitled Murder in Dealey Plaza, which has 9 contributors, mm-hmm. which a lot of people think may be the single best book ever published on the assassination. It has a wonderful balance. I just tell you, I've edited an awful lot of books. I published over 2 dozen books, and I've done a huge amount of editing. That book just had a wonderful way in which it fell together. And, anyone who has a serious interest in the assassination might want to track down Murder in Dealey Plaza. Murder and Assassination Science have both been through 6 or 7 printings now. They've both been number 1 at different times on Amazon.com under the heading of Assassination. Mm-hmm. And The Great Zapruder Film Hoax has been one of the 3 most popular books in that heading of Assassination on Amazon now for, well, practically a year.
Yeah, I see some of the, I'm looking at your website now, theassassinationscience.com, and it looks like you have PhDs. You have a lot of professionals that concur with the analysis of the evidence.
Oh, that's absolutely right, Dan. I mean, I've been bringing people with a high level of competence. I mean, when you're getting into evidence that may be altered, you see, this is not the sort of thing that even the average medical professional is capable of dealing with. For example, when the House Select Committee reinvestigated the case in 1976-77, they were, the medical panel was given the autopsy x-rays and asked if they were authentic, and they compared the dentures with dentures taken of JFK while he was living, and the dentures were the same, so they concluded that the x-rays were authentic. But see, they simply weren't prepared to cope with fake autopsies that had been, you know, were alterations of originals. They just didn't have the competence to do it. So this requires special levels of expertise, which is why I've had to, you know, brought in and been working with people with the very high levels of competence of dealing with some of the very subtle, complex issues that arise here.
And that's the type of things that the government would not have been smart enough to cover up.
You're getting at it, Dan. In other words, they were pretty smart. They were pretty clever. I mean, they carried this off after all. I mean, it's 40 years after the death of JFK, and we're still, you know, trying to figure out all of it. Although I think at this point now, we have about figured out about 90 to 95% of exactly what happened. If you read Murder in Dealey Plaza, you'll just be astonished at the detail with which we know who did what, for example, in terms of reshooting the photographs, the autopsy photographs, which appears to have been done by a fellow named Robert Knutson, who was a White House photographer, who over the weekend told his family that he was involved in photographing the autopsy, but he had no role during the autopsy in photographing it. He does appear to have had that role, however, in reshooting it and creating, you know, the new photographic record that presented the wounds in different ways than they had actually occurred.
Well, I think if any of our listeners have ever watched the television series Crime Scene Investigation, CSI, they would know that in any type of crime scene, you can come up with completely different evidence if you just know where to look.
That's right, Dan.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And see, I mean, the government is still, you know, trying to fake us out of our jocks. I mean, it goes like, go back to the Pentagon. You know, I say nobody, in my opinion, who goes, just looks at the three or four or five of the photographs I have right there, just scanned down, you know, to 15 studies plus. Just look at those photographs of the Pentagon immediately after the hit. You see the grass is perfectly clean. You see the tire tracks from a couple of fire trucks. You see no evidence of any, you know, large airline having impacted with the ground before it hit the building. It's quite a feat of flying. If somebody were to just sort of crash into the building, they'd do it through the roof, for example. They wouldn't come in from the side. That particular part of the building, by the way, Dan, as I'm sure you're aware, but maybe some of your readers are not, had just undergone reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened to be the area that would have the least documents, records, and personnel occupying at the time. It would be the one that would turn out to be the easiest to reconstruct because it had just gone through reconstruction. I mean, the whole thing appears to have been rigged in a way to manipulate the American people into supporting this, not just this war against terrorism, but actually the invasion of Iraq for all kinds of phony reasons, including, of course, the weapons of mass destruction, the alleged involvement of Saddam Hussein in 9-1-1 and terrorist activities by Iraq, all of which appear to have been false claims, not to mention other exaggerated false claims about the use of, you know, getting yellow cake from Niger, which, of course, has led to the scandal that is now threatening to envelop the White House, where the wife, Valerie Plame, of Ambassador Wilson, who investigated that, was exposed as a covert CIA operative. And you know, the irony, Dan, is that she was responsible for a network that was investigating the actual existence of weapons of mass destruction around the world. The CIA has been outraged by this because she had one of the most sensitive assignments in the entire CIA and one of the most vital for national security, and yet the Bush administration exposed her in retaliation for Ambassador Wilson explaining that one of their claims, one of the reasons for invading Iraq, was false.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very slow to move on conspiracy theories in general, but there is a mounting evidence as we review the facts. I do know that the planes that hit the towers, they showed the engines on the street. I don't recall seeing the engines being carried away from the Pentagon.
No. Yeah, right. That's exactly right. Those engines are virtually indestructible. I mean, consider what they, how they do, how they perform in the air. My God, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right. No, Michael Moore said it best. He said, you know, I don't believe in conspiracy theories except those that are true.
Okay. That sounds like a logical approach.
Political and religious news, supernatural happenings, unexplained mysteries, conspiracy theories, and special guests along with your calls. Right here on the Edge Radio Broadcast with your host, Daniel Ott.
Jim, tell us some more about the supposed Zapruder film. Why is the government misleading the public?
Well, I think the Zapruder film functioned as the backbone of the cover-up. I mean, what you had really was a transition, a change in government that was being effectuated by powerful forces within the government, elements of the Secret Service, of the military, of the CIA, who were responsible for bringing this about in order to bring into place the policies of Lyndon Johnson in preference to those of Jack Kennedy. And it was being done in such a way that you would preserve this tremendous allegiance and dedication to Jack Kennedy by making it appear as though this was simply a continuation of his administration having been caused by a lone demented gunman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just to make one fairly obvious point that most people, however, don't ponder, Dan, all the records from those the Warren Commission investigation were locked up for 75 years on the grounds of national security. Now, I'm convinced that 75 years was chosen because it's the average lifespan of an American. So by locking those documents and records up for 75 years, you ensure that basically anyone who is alive at the time of the assassination would not be alive at the time of the release of the records. But here's the telling point. Namely, if Jack Kennedy was killed by a lone demented gunman, then there is no national security aspect to the case and therefore no justification for locking those records up for 75 years.
Wow, that's interesting. It just seems to be a trail of mismanagement by the government to hide things from us. It seems like there's a lot of high-profile incidents that we're only getting about half of the information that's really out there on issues.
If that much, you know. I mean, it's taken us 40 years to really piece together what happened to JFK. Now, you made some remarks about conspiracy theories that I'd like to talk about, however, briefly, namely that conspiracies are actually as American as apple pie. All it requires is two or more individuals collaborating together to bring about some illegal end. So when a couple of guys knock off a 7-Eleven, Dan, they're committing a conspiracy. Now, they aren't usually prosecuted under a conspiracy statute. They'd be prosecuted under an armed robbery statute, say, for example. But most American conspiracies are economic. Enron, WorldCom, those are conspiracies by the managers, the chief executive officers and so forth of businesses to rip people off for millions of money. You now know how these energy companies were ripping off California during the energy crisis.
Oh,
they
yeah.
were deliberately manipulating the electric grids so that Californians would be shortchanged and overcharged. And, of course, they were doing it to the tunes of billions of dollars. So some of these economic ripoffs are really massive on a huge scale. Sometimes they're relatively small. For example, when Martha Stewart is prosecuted for insider trading, well, notice what a perfect example of a conspiracy is insider trading, because it's somebody giving information they have on the inside to somebody else who benefits from it. Often it's on a reciprocal basis, so that when they're in a position to benefit you, they'll turn around and do the same sort of thing for you, which is why, you know, in Wall Street, this has to be carefully guarded against. But, of course, often these kinds of statutes aren't very rigorously enforced, so that you get lots of people benefiting. In fact, insider trading seems to have been involved in 9-1-1. There's a tremendous amount of interest in some options on the airlines that were involved, you know, whose planes were involved in the crash that have never been collected. These are so-called put options that are predicting that the stock in an airline is going to go down.
Yeah.
And you know, here's an obvious indication, Dan, that the American government has not been pursuing 9-1-1 seriously at all, because it's very obvious, easy to find out who put these put options on United Airlines and American Airlines, and it hasn't been done. That would tell you who had advanced knowledge that this was going to take place.
Yeah, I was aware of that pre-9/11 stock manipulation going on there around the airline industry on that.
That's right.
So let me ask you this then. In your analysis, how many shooters were there and how many bullets?
Well, that's good. There appear to have been shooters at six different locations, Dan. Let me go through it with you. Jack was hit in the back by a shot that appears to have been fired from the top of the county records building.
Right.
There were three shots that appeared to have been fired from that second floor of the Daltex building. One shot that missed and injured that distant bystander, James Tagg. A second that missed and hit the chrome strip over the windshield. And the third shot that hit him in the back of the head after the limousine was brought to a halt. No shots appear to have been fired from the sixth floor window where Lee Oswald was alleged to have been located. He was actually, as I mentioned before, down in the lunchroom on the second floor where he was waiting probably for a phone call that never came. Some shots, I believe, were fired from the opposite end of the book depository, however, at John Connolly. As many as three shots fired from there at Connolly. Now Connolly, I believe the conspirators didn't realize, the assassins didn't know, was in the car. They thought it was going to be Ralph Yarborough, the liberal senator who was an opponent of Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon had a huge argument with JFK that morning, trying to get Ralph Yarborough into the limousine with Jack Kennedy. And I think that JFK turned him down on the grounds that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. But I don't think there was time to inform the assassins that this was not Ralph Yarborough, but rather John Connolly. It created some confusion, of course, politically, because Connolly was a conservative Democrat, whereas JFK was a liberal Democrat. But, so I think it actually worked to the advantage of the conspirators that Connolly was in the vehicle and was hit. Then, from the left front, a shot was fired that went through the windshield and hit Jack in the throat, as I said, from that above-ground sewer. And then there appeared to have been two shots fired from the right front, one from the intersection of the triple underpass. That was the frangible bullet, hit him in the right temple and exploded and blew his brains out the back of the head. And then a shot appears to have been fired from the grassy knoll that ironically appears to have missed and wound up in the dirt. So there were 8, 9, or 10 shots fired from what appear to have been 6 different locations.
So let me ask you this then, and think about this just for a second before you answer. For, say, a listener out there who says, this guy just has an axe to grind against the Warren Commission, what would be the one indisputable fact that you have learned that said, this is it, this is the tying bind that says it was not a lone shooter, it was not Lee Harvey Oswald? What is that one fact you can give the caller that you convinced them, and it convinced you that you're just not mad at the Warren Commission's outcome?
Well, the autopsy x-rays have been altered. We have no axe to grind. Why would professional people of the competence and quality of David Livingston, Bob Livingston, MD, this man's world famous. He was a founding member of an organization that received the Nobel Peace Prize. He was the most distinguished member of the civil service in its history. He had an international reputation as a world authority on the human brain. Why would he or David W. Manick, MD, PhD, an outstanding physician who's at a clinic that's in the forefront of radiation therapy, including proton therapy for prostate cancer and other maladies, why would Charles Crenshaw, MD, who is actually present on both locations, why would John P. Costella, PhD in electromagnetism, who is from a distinguished Australian university, why would I published over 24 books, I have a distinguished professorship, why would any of us risk our reputation on nonsense? What we did was to go back to this case and seek to reconstruct it from the ground up. We went back to the most basic evidence to try to figure out which was authentic and which wasn't. We were well aware of all the rumor and speculation about this case. We also, as I discovered, there was a superabundance of evidence in this case, but it was very contradictory and inconsistent. So what we did was to reconstruct the case from the ground up. And you can go through it with us. You can discover what we discovered as we discovered it. You can look at all the evidence. I have published these books with all of the evidence in the books. You see all the photographs. You see the documents. You see my efforts to explain to the Department of Justice what we had discovered, that the autopsy x-rays had been altered, that the brain had been substituted. You see the Department of Justice just giving me the back of its hand. You can go through step by step with our discoveries, and you'll learn everything, practically everything there is to know about the case from these three books.
Uh-huh. Hey, now in my kind of research in this issue here, just a little bit, I'm not claiming to be an expert by any means, but I have never seen a website that says, here's the explanation of how Lee Harvey Oswald made 6 shots and how he did it. Have you ever seen a website like that? And did it make any sense if you did?
Well, there is a group, there's an active disinformation operation going on out there. I mean, a lot of us believe that, in fact, the Sixth Floor Museum, which is situated in the book depository, is one of the centers for a disinformation campaign that's intended to preserve the illusion that the Warren Commission report is defensible. a leading figure in that category generally, of course, is this guy Gerald Posner, who published a book in 1993 entitled Case Closed that was really just a more popularized version of the Warren Commission report. What's fascinating about Posner, of course, is that he was publishing his book on the verge of the release of a whole lot of new documents and records. When Oliver Stone's film appeared in late 1991, JFK, it generated such a sensation and so much interest in the case that pressure was brought on Congress to pass a law that would release these documents and records. And George Bush, the former director of the CIA, was president at the time, opposed this. He was violently opposed to it. And when it passed over his opposition, he refused to appoint the members to the board, which had to await the incoming Clinton administration. So there was like an 18-month delay in the members of the Assassination Records Review Board getting around to doing their job. Now, they had the authority to declassify documents and records held by the Secret Service, the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, and so forth, where the only entity that could override their decisions to declassify was the President of the United States. Now, some very interesting things happened. For example, when the ARRB notified the Secret Service that they wanted these records for presidential protection motorcades for JFK in the past, the Secret Service destroyed the records. They said the Office of Naval Intelligence was like a black hole. They couldn't get anything out of it. And that's all very telling, you see, because mm-hmm. the Secret Service actually, from our research, set him up. Mm-hmm. And if you contrast this, here's a very telling point I hadn't explained. The motorcade, the vehicles were all in the wrong order, Dan. The president should have been in the middle. He should have been preceded by a flatbed truck that where you had support the cameras for the television and newsreels. And because mm-hmm. this is a political event, right? You have the lowest ranking dignitaries in the beginning. So you have the mayor and then, you know, the vice president. The crowd roars and it increases. Then you got the president. He's surrounded by the press. Instead, they canceled the flatbed truck. They put the president right up front. So he's the very first vehicle. They put the press right in the back. In fact, guess who was in the very last limousine? In the very last limousine in the motorcade was the president's personal physician. So that if the president actually had needed medical help, and of course he did.
Well, I was going to say Geraldo Rivera, but no.
He'd be least likely, least able to get there. In fact, he arrived late, you know, and Jack Kennedy had various medical maladies, and so you really didn't need the attention of somebody who was an expert on his medical history. Plus, here's another oddity. All the vehicles were of different makes and models and colors. I don't think you'll find that in any other presidential motorcade. They're almost always monotonously the same, you know, uniformly black mm-hmm. limousines of a similar model and make. And in this case, they were all very different. I think that's so that the conspirators, you know, the assassins, could tell just by looking who was where in the motorcade.
Hmm.
But by putting Jack way up front, you know, they made him particularly vulnerable. Hey, the motorcycle patrolman complained that they'd been told not to ride forward of the rear wheels of the limousine. They said that was the damnedest formation they'd ever been instructed to. And, of course, it meant that Jack was completely exposed. Get this, his military aide would normally have sat in the front between the driver, William Greer, and the agent in charge, Roy Kellerman, was moved to that last limousine where he was riding beside the president's personal physician. Now, if he had been in place, then the shot that went through the windshield would have hit him. It wouldn't have hit Jack Kennedy.
Huh. Well, who was mixing up the motorcade? And was that mixed up at the very end, or was that planned from the beginning?
Oh, but the rearrangement of the vehicles actually took place at Love Field. But, I mean, this was carefully orchestrated. I mean, it could be very confusing. You have locations at different locations, you know, scattered around Dealey Plaza. I mean, it's an ambush. It's basically a military-style execution. But you've got to know where your target is. This is one reason why when Jackie got off the plane, she was given this enormous bouquet of red roses by the wife of the mayor, Earl Campbell. Jackie always thought that was odd because elsewhere in Texas, they'd been traveling, she'd been given these huge bouquets of yellow roses. Nellie Connelly was given a huge bouquet of yellow roses. So here you have Nellie in the middle with this huge bouquet of yellow, Jackie in the back with a huge bouquet of red roses. That's a visual indication to the shooters where the target is. The target is beside the red roses. Red marks the line for the shooter.
Well, I never would have come up with that thought, but sounds like you really went down into the deep realms of conspiracy to get that out. But
it's just called, you know, research, Dan. I mean, there's nothing here There's no avenue to studying the death of JFK, whether you start with a Warren report, whether you start with the Secret Service, whether you start with the CIA, whether you start with the military, you start with J. Edgar Hoover, you start with Lyndon Johnson. Every avenue of approach, you start with the medical evidence, they all lead to the same conclusions. Now, let me tell you a little story. I mean, a couple individuals I got to know very well who had intimate knowledge about the assassination included a woman by the name of Madeline Duncan Brown. She began an affair with Lyndon Johnson in 1948. Now, she was not his only mistress, but she bore him his only son, not his only child born out of wedlock, but his only male offspring, Stephen, born in 1950. Stephen would live to 1990 when he'd die of bone marrow cancer. Madeline was invited out to the home of Clint Murchison, one of the great oil barons, the night before the assassination. Also there was H.L. Hunt, his oil rival. H.L. used to describe himself as the richest man in the world. Richard Nixon was there. He was driven out by a Republican leader who worked with Madeline in a bank building where she was a young advertising executive. J. Edgar Hoover was there. She thought perhaps this was an event in honor of Hoover. Hoover used to come to Dallas frequently and stay with Murchison on his way out to Del Mar Racetrack, which was owned by Murchison. And when Hoover would put down bets, why, invariably, his horses would win. Rather nice arrangement, Dan. You know, if you and I could figure out how we could arrange, you know, our bets to always win, mm-hmm. It would be quite something. There was also John J. McCloy, the former High Commissioner to Germany, former Chief Executive Officer of Chase Manhattan Bank, was there. George Brown, Brown and Root Heavy Construction, was there. When the Vietnam War went down, Brown and Root was hired to dredge a new port at Cam Ranh Bay. Now, Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports, but the government shelled out about $1 billion to Brown and Root to dredge one there. Brown and Root now, of course, is a subsidiary of Halliburton. And I don't need to tell you, Dan, I'm sure, what's going on with Halliburton with these no-bid contracts in Iraq, where all the buddies, you know, of the gas and oil industry and Bush and Cheney are ripping off the American people and the Iraqis because they're getting paid huge sums of money for work they're not performing. God, it even gets down to giving decent chow to the soldiers who are engaged in combat. It's truly a disgrace. Lyndon Johnson showed up late in the evening at this event at the Murchison's. He wasn't expected to be there. He and these heavy hitters disappeared into a conference room for 15 or 20 minutes. After it was over, Lyndon strode over to Madeline, and she expected he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. 6 weeks later, on New Year's Eve at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, they had a rendezvous. Madeline confronted Lyndon with rumors that were rampant in Dallas at the time that he had been involved since no one stood to gain more personally. Lyndon blew up at her and told her the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out. Now, Madeline's report has been corroborated by Billy Saul Estes, the Texas Wheeler dealer who was involved in many scandals that ripped off the American government for large sums of money for him and his cronies, who included Lyndon Johnson and John Connolly. Billy Saul gave an interview to a French investigative reporter by the name of William Raymond, who published it in a French magazine whose title translates Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, talking about how LBJ was in deep political trouble, several scandals were enveloping him, how there was going to be a vote in the Senate on Friday, 22 November 1963, involving the Bobby Baker scandal that was going to tarnish him. He was certain that Lyndon was going to be dropped from the ticket, that Jack wasn't going to run with him again. JFK had already told Evelyn Lincoln, his executive secretary, he wasn't going to run with Lyndon again. Richard Nixon even was being quoted in the paper that morning predicting that Lyndon and that JFK was going to drop LBJ. And Billy Saul explained how Lyndon sent Cliff Carter, his chief assistant, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. Now, of course, you have a new book by a guy named Barr McClellan, who happens to be the father of Scott McClellan, who's George W. Bush's press secretary, talking about how he was a member of the law firm that used, you know, one of the law firms that Lyndon used, and how the guy who was the boss of the firm and engaged in collusion with Lyndon in helping to plan the assassination. Blood, Money, and Power is the name of that book.
There you go. Hey, Jim, in the final minutes we got left, why don't you tell the listeners here about your books and your website and the final comment.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks very much. Anyone who's interested in pursuing this and seeing the evidence for themselves can find it in three books entitled Assassination Science, Murder in Dealey Plaza and the Great Zapruder Film Hoax. They're available at the major bookstores, including, for example, Barnes & Noble. They're also available on Amazon.com. You can often get a good price, you know, two of them for, say, a third off, available through Amazon.com, where they've all ranked very highly. The first two have ranked aside number one out of 11 or 1,200 books on the title of under the heading of assassination. Go to my website, assassinationscience.com, and you'll find leads on all kinds of issues that may concern you, including, of course, not only the death of JFK, but also 9-1-1 and a whole lot of other controversial political issues where our government appears to have been practicing deception and deceit in order to manipulate the American people.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks for being on the show, folks. You've been listening to James Fessner, Ph.D. Jim, can we have you back on the show on a future date?
Dan, that would be my great pleasure.
All right. We should have this interview up on the website sometime tomorrow, commercial-free, Jim. And thanks for being on the Edge radio broadcast.
Thanks very much, Dan.
You bet.